Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
I have the great privilege of welcoming Dr. Carl to the podcast, a science enthusiast dedicated to engaging people in science. Carl has worked as a medical practitioner, radio host, TV host, author of many, many books, and loved by all. Dr. Carl and I talk about cockroach milk, technological advancements, and baby wasps who eat their way out of a living worm. You will definitely be more knowledgeable by the end. Enjoy.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Carl. What an absolute pleasure to share some time with you today on the podcast.
Oh, Dr. Danny, you're too kind.
Look, as an English nerd, I want to start by acknowledging the names of some of your books. 50 Shades of Grey Matter, my personal favourite, Game of Knowns, House of Carls, Shortback and Science. I really enjoy these. I feel like you really enjoy creating these titles as well.
It's nice to get into the local zeitgeist of the time.
And do you find that this resonates with your readers?
It's a little bit of a hook, and people say, what's the book about? I say, well, just bits and pieces of what scientists discovered and found interesting last time.
Which is absolutely true, because Vital Science, your latest book, is really something for the entire family, filled and jam-packed with so many different facts about science.
It's a mixture of what I find interesting plus what other people tell me they find interesting. Surprisingly, a small but rich source of knowledge are the radio stations who ring up and say that cockroach milk is a new superfood, which I'd never heard of. Like all good myths, there was a tiny nub of truth in it.
I loved that section. I found it very gross. But what I found, you know, a cow is quite big, so I could understand you milking a cow. But a cockroach, like how many cockroaches do you need to make some milk that's drinkable?
Well, to get a teaspoon, you kind of got to milk about 1,000 of them. It takes you half a day to do it. And the way you milk them, in inverted commas, is you've got a little tiny pouch and you shove a bit of tissue paper in there and you pull out the tissue paper once it's soaked with milk and then squeeze it dry. You can imagine it takes a long time. Mm. They're kind of like a platypus, right? So the vast majority of cockroach species, have eggs. They make their babies via eggs, and they either carry the eggs around with them all the time, or they dump the eggs quietly in some sort of cold, dark place where nobody will see them and eat them. But there's one species of cockroach, the Pacific beetle cockroach, that gives birth to live young, and then they migrate their way into this pouch, and then milk comes through the wall of the pouch. It's very similar to what happens with a platypus. The platypus doesn't have nipples, gives birth to little babies. They get into the pouch and then milk comes through the wall of the pouch and they lick it up.
I found that fascinating, that just kind of seeps through their skin.
We know that evolution is real, and breast milk, we know, can feed babies for ages.
Is that something that really irks you as a scientist, these really weird misconceptions or myths?
It's difficult. There's different sorts of rubbish out there. You know, there's pseudoscience, and then there's the medical pseudoscience. And the thing that bothers me about that is that it kills people, and I've been there when it actually happened. And so we're getting away from the cockroach milk. In Australia, thanks to vaccinations, we had a 20-year history of the number of babies dying from whooping cough being zero. And then on Channel 9, A Current Affair, they decided that they'd try and sell some more, whatever they sell, dog food, and they'd make up a controversy, which was, oh, one person says, one side of the argument is that vaccinations are good, but here's other people saying vaccinations are bad. Well, if there's two sides, this is the claim of A Current Affair on Channel 9, if there's two sides, then obviously both sides are of equal weight. No, they're not. And they kept on saying this over and over, and we end up with a situation where we had a drop in the herd immunity, and after 20 years of zero deaths, I was there at the kids' hospital in Camperdown when a baby died. So I don't know whether to say whether I'm irked or annoyed, because there's a whole bunch of emotions, especially when you're the one talking to the parents, and they say, but why did our baby die? And you can't give the answer, which is the herd immunity's gone down, because facts are not going to really help them right then.
And was this a catalyst for you going out into the media?
Yeah, the working as a doctor in the kids' hospital was the best job I ever had in my whole life. I never had a better job. It was just so satisfying. But all I could do was work with one family, because you don't just treat the child, you treat the family at a time. And then suddenly I found I could do more good in the media. Now, the trouble is you run into a concept I call the BAF, or the bull dust asymmetry factor. I'm going to say a sentence to you then, Dr. Danny. You ready for it? The daddy long-legged spider is the most poisonous spider on earth, but it can't kill you because the fangs are too short to get through your skin. It took me about 5 seconds to say that. There are four mistakes in that sentence. Four. And because of the time required for me to explain it is not about 5 seconds but about 5 minutes, it has a BAF, or bull dust asymmetry factor, of 60. It takes me 60 times longer to set the record straight than it does to simply say, no, there's four mistakes.
And it just sounds like such an interesting fact that you want to pass on to your friends, right? Even if it isn't true.
True. It's fascinating. And so with regard to vaccination, the argument against for and against vaccination is really easy to dispute, to put down all of the arguments against vaccination. It just takes time. And so the same with climate change. And I was reading a fascinating article in the New York Times about a Democrat guy. Now, you know how just for the audience, I'll refresh the political parties in America for the audience. So in America, we have the Republican Party, which is kind of equivalent to our Conservative Party, and we have the Democrat Party, which is kind of equivalent to our Conservative Party. Right? And so he was a Democrat, which is slightly less conservative, and he found that he could make money by telling lies in favour of Trump, even though he was a Democrat. Wow. He was against Trump. And so now he's making $15,000 a month. And so typically he'll get a photograph of Trump, and there's Trump with two women, even though they are not Michelle Obama and another woman. He'll say, this is Michelle Obama immediately after she gave the rude finger to Donald Trump while his back was turned. And so firstly, you don't see the rude finger. And secondly, it's not Michelle Obama. But it gets then retweeted over and over and then liked, and he's earning $15,000 a month. And so people who are passing it on, they don't even bother to look at it and say, well, I don't see the rude finger, and secondly, that's not Michelle Obama.
That's just wild, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. It's interesting, isn't it?
And terrifying, though, because, you know, you're talking about social media, which can often run out of hand occasionally, but then, you know, we're relating these back to truths in science, which, like you said, can harm people, and it's quite terrifying that people just blindly retweet or believe something without the facts. It's easier to read a meme, like you said, than it is to do the research.
Well, it's not a new phenomenon. So a good example would be the Great Fire of London in 1666. Where you had 80% of the population in inner London lose their houses, and it was incredibly destructive to life and housing, and they wanted to blame somebody, so they blamed this guy who was obviously the right guy to blame, because he was both a Catholic when England was Protestant, and also he was French when they were kind of at war with France. And so he confessed to setting fire, the fire going, of the Great Fire in London in Westminster, and they were about to hang him when they suddenly noticed that Westminster had never caught on fire. So what they did was they brought him back and convinced him of the error of his ways, and he made a new confession. And he confessed to throwing fire grenades through the windows of a bakery in Pudding Lane, where the fire actually started. Now, there are a few problems with that, which all came out at the court case. Firstly, he'd had a difficult birth and both of his shoulders were wrecked, shoulder dystocia, and he couldn't actually throw anything. Secondly, the bakery didn't have any windows at the front. Thirdly, an Englishman, a captain of a ship, testified that he was on his ship in the middle of the English Channel between France and the United Kingdom when the fire actually started.
Wow.
However, there on the jury of 12 people, there were three of the family members that lived in the bakery, and he was French, and he was Catholic, and so he got executed.
Wow. And I'm sure this has just gone on throughout history, you know, repeatedly. It's just crazy, isn't it? So I know this explanation could take a very long time, but what do you say to people who don't want to vaccinate their children?
In my case, I listen to what they're saying, and in many, many cases, they've got a sort of a urgency of pressure of speech. They've just got so much they've got to get out, and it doesn't matter what I say. I could tell them that I'm the Lord and Master of time and space, and I can levitate, and I'll give them a bag of gold. They wouldn't listen, right? They've just got to get out what they've got to get out, and they do it for 5 or 10 minutes, and then they walk off satisfied. And most of what they've said is mistruths with occasional tiny nuggets of truth that have been taken out of context or misinterpreted. There's not a lot you can say. Occasionally you come across people who are actually interested in the facts, and then you can say, it's all happened before, so it's happened again. And so then you've got 20 minutes to explain to them that we have ice ages roughly every 150 million years when the ice is 3.3 kilometres thick over New York, over Montreal, and then and at 1 kilometre thick over Germany, and that then within each ice age is there's smaller ages, and you have to bring in the Milankovic effect, and then you have here you're talking BAF or bull dust asymmetry factor of maybe 200, because they say, well, it's happened before, so it's happening again. Okay, let's see what the geologists tell us has happened before, and occasionally you'll get somebody who'll actually want to see how it's different, but mostly they've already made up their mind.
That's why your job's so important, I guess, so you can just keep telling, you know, the scientific facts. And I think when people are exposed to things enough, you know, they do believe them, or they find some truth in them.
They accept the science, yeah. Getting back to cockroach milk, it turns out that one species of cockroach does make a tiny amount of milk which exudes through the pouch wall for the babies to lick up. And some scientists, of course, looked at it and thought, oh, what does it taste like? And one of them just got a tiny bit of it on his fingertip and put it to his lips and went, doesn't taste like anything. But they analysed it and they found that it was very high in fat, and therefore it had lots of energy. Yeah, because fat has got lots of energy in it. And so on the basis of the fact that it's one of the highest energy milks known, because it's got so much fat, they said it's the Daily Mail said it's a new superfood. Well, if energy is the basis of a superfood, mate, go to your local supermarket and get some cooking oil. It's 100% fat.
I try not to have too much against cockroaches. They're part of our world, but I don't think I'd really want to drink their cockroach milk, to be quite honest.
Well, you'd have to milk an awfully large number of cockroaches over a couple of years or so to get enough to get a whole glass of milk. But on the other hand, with genetic engineering, or with 3D printing,
I'm just seeing all these little tiny cockroaches, like, you know, how they milk cows in these little machines getting milk.
And now they're going to milk the poor little cockroaches. Oh, well, with cows, things are changing. So we're definitely, and this is not in this book of mine called Vital Science, but it'll be in the next book, we're definitely heading down the pathway of lab-grown meat. Because meat does have a lot of nutrients in a small package, but it comes at a cost. And so if you go to the butcher's shop and sort of stare at 1 kilogram of cow sitting there on a plate, to get that 1 kilogram of cow on that plate in the butcher's window took 15,000 kilograms of water. Wow. Of fresh water. Now that water is not lost. It's not wasted. It just goes around and around. But yeah. What it means is that that water in Australia is no longer available as fresh water. It'll go through the cycle and come back in a couple of dozen years out of the sky, but we've given up that fresh water temporarily. And it's a very high cost, and lab-grown meat has a possibility of giving us meat at a much lower environmental cost. And of course there's the ethical costs for those who are vegetarian. My daughter is vegetarian for ethical reasons, and I fully sympathize.
Are there any drawbacks to lab-grown meat? I've often thought, is there anything that I don't know about from a scientific angle that isn't good for us, or it's fine?
We don't know yet. Okay. It's currently being made very expensively. For a kilogram, has dropped down from $250,000 a kilogram, which is too much, and it's down to about five times the price of regular meat. And we're just on the beginning of the curve, and it's kind of like smartphones. Like the iPhone 1 and 2 didn't actually work. The iPhone 3 in 2009 actually worked, and I was amazed because I had this little thing, and I could carry it in my hand, and I walked across Spain carrying it with me. We did the El Camino walk, 790 kilometres across Spain. And there was this little thing which you could make phone calls on. Yeah, that's pretty good. And take photographs, and could translate from English to Spanish and back again. And could also take notes, and you could surf the web, and it was a GPS system, and it was just amazing. And now they've all got it. And there's an example of how fast the technology is moving. Mm-hmm. On the bus the other day, saw this 2-year-old kid sitting on his mother's lap, and he saw something out the window that he thought was interesting. So he put his thumb and forefinger on the window glass and moved them apart to try and make it bigger. So things are moving rapidly.
Wow.
Lab-grown meat, I'm reckoning 10 years, it'll be at a cost price, and then we'll know, it'll be cost equivalent to regular meat, mm-hmm. But much cheaper in environmental cost, and then we'll know, begin to see what the side effects are. But I don't think there should be anything different. It's just actin and myosin filaments running over each other to make muscle.
I love how that 2-year-old thinks the world is a touchscreen.
Well, I remember when the first smartphones with the touchscreen started coming through, and we had a niece, and she was playing with my wife's non-smartphone, and she kept on trying to make it work by rubbing the screen, and she didn't realise you had to press buttons. So she's part of that generation.
Maybe we can invent some special glasses or something that do magnify the world for you when you need it. That could be something.
We're heading down that pathway as well, providing we get through this nasty global warming thing. Mm-hmm. And so here's a message of hope for you, right, for us in the audience. If we really care about it, in other words, we need to have the politicians on side, which means we need to have the current politicians out and people like you and your mates in. I ran for politics. I failed. That's where the power is. Mao Zedong said, power grows out of the barrel of a rifle. In some parts of the world it does, but in Australia and the democratic countries, it grows out of the parliament. So mm-hmm. Everybody get in there to parliament to make things better. And if you do, we can now fix up global warming. So number one, with regard to global warming, we can go entirely carbon-free for electricity over the whole world in 10 years if the politicians make that decision.
Wow.
Yeah. So just think about World War II and the 7th of December 1941, and what the and how the Americans went ape and shifted their economy entirely onto a war footing. So that's number one. There's another part of number one. 10 years for electricity, 15 years for transport, agriculture and livestock, which is about one quarter of our carbon output. We can bring that back to essentially zero in about 30 years because it's from DNA, and DNA is alive and it'll try and fight us. So it'll resist what we try to do. It'll be a bit harder, but we can do it. And the second message of hope is that each generation of students is 9 IQ points smarter than the previous generation. Yeah, so each generation of students is 9 IQ points smarter than the generation before. Wow. It's called the Flynn Effect. Look it up on my ABC homepage. Just type in go to Google, Dr. Carl ABC Flynn, FLYNN, or smarter. And then the third one is that we are living in the most peaceful time ever in the history of the human race. And people find that hard to believe, and I'll explain why they find it hard to believe. But the proof of it is quite straightforward. Just read the book Factfulness, Factfulness, like three words all turned into one word, by Hans Rosling. Read that book, or The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker. And they deal with the big scale and the small scale. And on a big scale, we've had big wars, and people say that wrongly, that the Second World War was the most bloody war in history on a percentage basis. Well, no. In 755 AD, to put down the An Lushan revolt in China, the Chinese emperor killed one in every three people in China.
Wow.
One in every six people in the whole world.
Wow.
Genghis Khan, to build the world's largest empire, killed one in every nine people alive on Earth. Second World War, one in 44. So we're getting better. Wars are still terrible and dangerous for living things, but we're getting better. And on a small scale, looking at slavery and murder rates and judicial torture and violence, they're all heading downwards in the right direction. And why do you think that things are so bad? Because of the motto of the commercial media, which is, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just personally, I have to access my news myself because honestly, watching the news night after night just increased my anxiety by tenfold. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. So I don't even watch the television news anymore. If I want my news, I access it myself for my own mental health. It's just awful.
It is following the rule of if it bleeds, it leads, combined with clickbait. Mm-hmm. So one example that I saw was, and this is a very mild one, was the headline was, this Harvard professor says that you should eat 6 chips a day. You know, the hot chips that come out of deep fried. And what the professor actually said was, if you're going to eat these, and he called them fries, but the same thing, if you're going to eat them, have no more than 6 a day. Let me give you a few quick truths so we get these out of the way. Firstly, a whale, when it's diving and doing filter feeding, can more than double its weight. So you've got a 60-ton fin whale. That's pretty big, the second biggest whale, 60-ton. And it opens its mouth as it's diving to take in all the water and a bit of krill. And it takes in 70 tons of water. Its weight doubles, more than doubles, to 130 tons. In that 70 tons of water is only a lousy 11 kilograms of krill, so it has to repeat the dive over and over and over 90 times to get the 1 ton of krill that it needs to keep its 60-ton body alive. What about the fact that in the northern parts of Australia, the birds set fire to the grasslands to force the animals out into the open where they can swoop down on them and kill them?
Birds are smart. I read all about bird brains, and they're smarter than you think.
And unfortunately, in Australia, cats kill 1 million birds every day. Sorry about that. A bit of a downer. But now that we know about it, we can do it. And hummingbirds are about an hour or half an hour away from death by starvation. And sometimes they don't make it through the night. So when a hummingbird is hovering, it's using up energy so fast that if that was a human being, they'd have to have a can of Coke with all of the 15 teaspoons of sugar or 12 teaspoons of sugar every 9 minutes just to not starve to death. And at night they go into a hibernation state. They're not going through their full high energy thing. But sometimes when they wake up in the morning, they haven't got enough energy. They've either died of starvation overnight, or, in other words, they haven't woken up, or they wake up and they haven't got enough energy to go into the full hover, and they can't get their food and they die. And in the full hover, their tongue is going in and out 20 times a second. Their heart is beating 20 times a second. Their wings are going 80 times a second. And they just can't maintain that to get the food that they need.
I'm really going to appreciate the hummingbird a bit more now.
Yeah. And there's another story about how grunting in tennis improves your performance.
Yes.
So what happens there is that by the act of grunting, you sort of stiffen the centre core of your body, and it lets you propel the ball, if you're serving, 5% faster. And then at the other end, or the person who's receiving the ball, well, the ball's moving so fast that they can't react to what they're seeing. They sort of have to try to get the idea of where the ball's going to go. And part of that is hearing the racket smash on the ball. And if you cough and cover it, then you slow them down by about 5%. So it gives a double advantage to the server, making them faster and confusing the receiver. And then finally, there's another story here about how trees are made mostly of air. So if you get a 100-kilogram pot of dirt and put a little tiny seedling in there that weighs hardly anything, after 5 years, that seedling has grown into a 100-kilogram weight of tree, and you've still got your 100 kilograms of dirt left behind.
And when I read that, I thought it's something that you know, because you know that the soil doesn't disappear when you plant a plant in a pot. But after reading it, I was like, oh, yeah, I hadn't actually thought about it in the way you had presented it. So it was super interesting.
Well, I kind of, like you, knew it, but I hadn't even really considered it. Mm. That the tree is made, the dry weight of the tree is basically carbohydrates. You know, there's a little bit of magnesium and iron and cobalt and selenium, but overwhelmingly it's carbohydrates, which are the atoms carbon, hydrogen and oxygen. Well, the carbon atoms come out of the air from carbon dioxide, the oxygen atoms come out of the air from carbon dioxide, and the hydrogen atoms come from the water that the tree gets. And that water, H2O, gets split into hydrogen atoms for the tree, to put into carbohydrates, and oxygen atoms, which then get fed to us. So the overwhelming majority of the dry weight of the tree, 93%, comes out of the air, and most of the rest comes out of the water. And the other thing is that trees also talk to each other via the, wait for it, the wood wide web.
That was my favourite part, actually, how they communicated with one another. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, so they got this underground mesh of a different species of creature, a fungus. And firstly, they live in symbiosis with the fungus, and then the waste products of the fungus feed the tree, and the waste products of the tree feed the fungus. But also the fungus has these little tiny fibres that run in all directions, and they send signals across. And so if you've got a big paddock with some trees at one end, and the trees get attacked by some insects, and so, the poor trees haven't got legs, so they usually do chemical warfare. So they start pumping out chemicals to fight the insects. But at the same time, a bunch of trees on the far side of the paddock, which haven't been attacked by the insects, they start making that chemical as well. And in fact, they can even do more clever things, the trees, to make up for the fact they don't have legs. If they're attacked by an insect, they can then pump out a chemical which attracts the insect that kills the insect that's attacking them. They call in a hitman.
That was the army worm and the wasp.
Call in the wasp to attack the army worm.
My 6-year old could not stop talking about this. And even when we'd finished reading it the next day, he's like, so the army worm, once the eggs are inside the army worm, how do they get out? And I was like, well, they eat their way out of the army worm. Sorry, buddy.
That's right. They eat their way. And in some cases, they kill the army worm really early, and sometimes they kill the army worm a lot later. So the army worm is sort of paralyzed and turns into a living husk that's gradually dying away, providing nutrition for the creatures chomping their way out from the inside.
Can I tell you my favorite story in vital science? My favorite story was the one about Bertha Benz and her husband Carl Benz of the Mercedes-Benz fame. I love Bertha. She's my hero.
Okay, so the story is that Bertha Benz did the first ever car trip, and I use this as a metaphor, an analogy, an example about how, because she did things and she changed things, we can also change with regard to what's happening with fixing up carbon emissions for transport. So Bertha Benz took off on this journey.
In secret. That's what I love. In secret.
Yeah, well, you tell us the story and I'll follow on after.
Okay. I just loved how she left her husband sleeping, took her two kids, went road trip, let's go, first road trip ever. And then as she goes along, she realises all these things aren't working with the car because no one's buying them. So there's nowhere to keep the petrol. She has to keep stopping at these chemists to fill up the car. And then there's no gearbox. And so she can't get up hills and she has to get shepherds to help push her up the hill. What else? There was no handbrake or something. So she kept figuring out all these things wrong with the car and then sent a telegram to her husband saying, hey, dude, you're going to fix this and then people will buy your car. Like, what a lady.
Her husband was a gifted engineer, but so was she. And she had an extra bit of nous that he didn't. He just wanted to tinker with the car and get it perfect based on 20-metre-long test drives. Yeah. So if you're taking it from here to there, 20 metres, you don't need a petrol tank. Literally, it did not have a petrol tank.
You kind of don't need a car, right?
Nobody had ever taken a car on a test drive. You know, by test drive, I mean more than half a kilometre. And she decided to go and see her mother 100 kilometres away. There were no road maps, so of course she went in the wrong direction. There were no roads, so she had to take the tracks that they would take wagons on. As you said, there were no petrol stations. There was no petrol tank. There was no... he hadn't designed an oil pump, so she had to keep on pouring oil in the top of the engine. There was no proper sealed radiator, so she had to stop and get water all the time. And as you said, no gearbox. And the handbrake involved getting her leather handbag and cutting it up to make the world's first handbrake. And so she did this on the road, you know, like the world's first road trip, because nobody had ever taken a car on a trip more than half, a couple of hundred metres, and she took it 100 kilometres, which is, serious stuff. And then she told her husband that you got to fix up all this stuff, and they became the world's biggest car company briefly, and they're still in business today. But the example is this with regard to aeroplanes. Aeroplanes are absolutely essential for commerce and for transport. You know, each year about 4 billion passenger journeys are taken and all sorts of stuff moves around the world on aeroplanes, but they put out about 3% of the world's carbon dioxide. And the thing about liquid hydrocarbons is it's got a huge amount of energy in them. Like, you might have heard about a thing called a barrel of oil, mm-hmm. on the news, and it's worth $50 or $75 or $100. A barrel of oil has the energy of two strong men working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for a whole year. So for one or $2 a week, you get the energy of two strong men per week. $1 or $2 a week. And so hydrocarbons were terrific to get us out of the nursery. But the thing is, you can't stay in the nursery forever. And now it's time for us to go into the real world. And we can't keep on using what we used in the nursery, like fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So what do you use for aeroplanes? I come up with the idea of liquid hydrogen. The trouble with liquid hydrogen is that it's got a very low density per volume. So in each cubic metre of kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, you got a certain amount of energy, but in liquid hydrogen or compressed hydrogen, you got 1/6 the energy, which means you need 6 times the volume. And that's easy. You get something like an Airbus 380 or a Boeing 747, and you just fill the entire top deck with fuel, and then so you've got far fewer passengers. You've got half as many passengers, but mm-hmm. you can still fly around the world and not put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And things that people saying, what? But that's impossible. Bertha Benz didn't find impossible to drive 100 kilometres.
And when you said, that story is a metaphor for change, now it really is, because it took her courage. It took her, she took risks. She had self-belief. It took intelligence and it took innovation. And I think they're the things that will take us to what you're talking about with aeroplanes.
Oh, I loved Bertha to pieces.
Me too. I love that. It was my favourite story. Now, you're still working with illustrator Jules Faber. What a great bloke. What's the process of working with an illustrator to complement the work you're trying to convey?
It falls into two categories. One category of illustration is the illustration that is explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a few of those scattered through the books, for example, explaining where the atoms go to make a tree. So the atoms that make up a tree, the carbon atoms come out of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide. The oxygen atoms come out of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide. The hydrogen atoms comes out of the water that lands on the tree from, you know, either rain or from you watering it or from the ground. So to explain all of that, he does specific diagrams, and the rest of it is just his entire brilliant, whimsical take on the weird stuff I've written about.
It seemed like he had a lot of knowledge about what you've done in the past, because there were little references to sleek geeks and all those kind of things. So I thought it was great. I love the pictures of you that he drew.
Well, he was very kind. I don't look as good as that in the... I don't think I'll even look as good as George Clooney. No, I dream of looking that good.
Now, science is really important for many reasons, and we've discussed them already on this a wonderful conversation, but an understanding of our world, to make good choices, to, you know, make change in the world for climate change, etc. How can we as teachers, parents, scientists, humans, better engage our young people in science so we can make these really important changes for our future?
I'm thinking teaching critical thinking, so that they know the difference between a lie and the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've got that, then you've got a firm base to build things on, as opposed to a world of shifting sand where people think that on stage Michelle Obama gave the rude finger to Donald Trump. On my Twitter feed, at Dr. Carl, DocTorKarl, I do ask people to try to avoid personal insults, and I ask them nicely, and if they don't do it after a couple of being asked nicely, I then just block them for being rude. I mean, I don't mind if you disagree with me. I'm very happy. You know, lay it on me. Tell me why. But if you say, I disagree with you and personal insult, well, that doesn't count. You're out.
And I totally agree with you. I mean, there's this kind of misconception, and I find this as a teacher, that if you don't agree on something, you can't be friends. And so as an English teacher, I really try and open up this conversation and dialogue that you can still disagree and have differing opinions and you can still be friends. Like, that's okay.
You don't have to be totally in a bubble where you live only with people who agree with you on everything.
That's right, because how much have you probably, and me definitely, learnt from someone else who had a slightly different opinion than you, and you've sat and listened and you've gone, oh, yeah, actually, and that's how you learn and grow, by listening, right?
Well, I learned from the Daily Mail. If it wasn't for the Daily Mail, I wouldn't have gone down the pathway of finding out that there is a cockroach that does make milk. I'm very impressed by that.
We're never going to look at cockroaches the same way again. Now, you do so much. You author, host a series of TV shows, host on Triple J, used to do Sleek Geeks, a column for Australian Geographic. What's next for you? Do you have an upcoming project, or are these things keeping you so busy?
Oh, there's always new stuff. I'm getting more into stage performing and mentoring.
Wow.
So firstly, here's an offer. I do two Science Q question and answer sessions with schools every week, usually on a Wednesday afternoon, anywhere in the world. Go to my homepage, drkarl.com, drkarl.com, to find out how to activate that free offer. So that's continuing. And I'm continuing with the university and doing radio and writing books. And I'm getting more and more into mentoring, into helping people along in their careers, either academic through my knowledge of which pathway is worthwhile going down, or directly in science communication, happy to give people guided tours through the radio stations and show them how it all actually works behind the scenes.
Wow, that's amazing. You've just gone off and done all these different things. How amazing is that? Could you have pictured all of this when you were back at Camperdown Hospital?
No way. Basically, my life has kind of been like a paddle pop stick in the gutter of life on a rainy day, and I just follow the currents wherever they take me.
That is the greatest imagery I've ever heard. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Carl. Look, I absolutely loved vital signs, as did my six-year-old. I will never look at a menu the same way again, and how it's trying to manipulate me into buying lots of things. But, you know, I think it's a great gift. It's also a great book that you can just read with the entire family. So I just want to thank you as a teacher and a parent. Thank you for your knowledge.
And look, thank you for having me on your wonderful podcast.